Hey, welcome to the Matthew Peterson Show. Welcome to the show. There's no greater welcome than we have for you today because we go into something that is near and dear and lay that out. And then we go into another topic that you've heard me talk about before that I want to hammer home. This is kind of a bread and butter kind of episode and day. First, I talk about the power of story. You know, I know everyone talks about that. It's platitude. The power of story. Stories are so powerful. I want to be a creative, and it's so great. There's something more powerful than I think people want to admit or even talk about, and that is that stories have civic and religious significance by their very nature, and the power of story is, in fact, the power to teach people what is good and what is evil. And if you screw that up and teach people that what's evil is good and what's good is evil, you have done great, great harm to society and culture and everything else. So we talk about that first, the depth and power of stories. And then I talk about the city on the hill again. And I'm not going to tire of talking about the city on a hill because I think it's the thing that we need to hear and internalize ourselves. And let me just say a caveat. I don't mean anything weird by it. I don't mean like weird, you know, communities, experimental communities of like Christian cults or something like this. I mean, that's what comes up in some people's mind. And that's sad because those are the words of Jesus Christ in the New Testament. Famous words that anyone, you know, Christian or not, religious or not, should be aware of and familiar with. That you are the city on a hill and that light can't be hid. That should convict us now because you've been taught to be atomized. You've been taught that's okay. You've been taught that, you know, you just live out in faithful way wherever you are. And there's some truth to that, of course, but there's something about the city on the hill in America where we are constantly refounding and we do always have a frontier with us, at least in our hearts, if not one that we should force in reality, that makes this different, that makes this hit home. So I encourage you to reach out to me if any of this moves you. I'd be interested in what you're thinking about either of these topics, stories or the city on a hill. And that is the end of my intro story. Let's get on with this show. Okay, so I want to talk about something near and dear, and just riff on it. We'll see how it goes. Not political, but in a way, all things are political in the deepest sense, because the political community is the largest community that you're part of, and it includes everything within it. So I don't mean partisan politics, but I want to talk about something that shapes all human beings. I want to talk about the way in which we learn what is good and what is evil. I want to talk about what affects us far more than any kind of instructional learning. I want to talk about something that has the power to shape civilizations over centuries. And I want to talk about something that is so powerful it can transcend civilization itself, hopping from civilization to civilization and forming the minds, the hearts, the souls of men. You know, thousands of years across time and space. What am I talking about? I'm talking about story. I'm talking about story. Stories are the way in which human beings learn ethics or what is good and bad, how they should live and behave. Stories are, in a way, substitute experience for the young and also the old that remind you or teach you for the first time what kinds of actions lead to what kinds of results. They give you insight into what human beings are, what nature is, the order of the universe. The main way in which we learn good and evil is through story. There's a sense in which a good story is not literally true but it is truer than your actual experience, because your actual experience doesn't have an order in it unless you think about what you do. That your actual experience doesn't necessarily teach you a damn thing. The story is looking at certain things as opposed to others and constructed in a continuous narrative in order to reveal something. Even if its primary goal is to, you know, give you some kind of pleasure or, you know, catharsis through purging out various emotions, it's revealing something to you in a very careful way. You can take the same event, right, and you can tell 1,000 different stories about it, and some of those stories will uplift the soul, will teach you something that you will never forget. Good teachers tell stories, even the most analytic ones, to make the point, because it's how we learn. It's not illogical. It's not irrational. In fact, it's very rational that we would have ways of inculcating, deep truths through stories. It's not irrational. We live in a time of a kind of rationalism that's actually disgusting, and it's irrational ultimately, like a science, logic. We don't know what logic is, first off, but there is no perfect system of logic or philosophy. The people who are pointed to often as creating those systems were smart enough to realize that it was open. It was just a way of, it wasn't a perfect closed system. There is no closed system that explains the universe for human beings. They're always, the best systems are just ways of thinking and arguing that are open to the mind-blowing reality within which we live that we can't quite fully comprehend. Nature itself points beyond itself. That's rational. That's logical. Nature itself can't explain itself by itself. That is deep Western wisdom. And in this sense, story is not, irrational or illogical or something like this. Story is a natural part, essential part of what binds us together and how we teach and learn about reality. This is ultimately why you should quit Netflix. This is ultimately why you should, as producer Vince wanted to talk about, get rid of these ridiculous collections of pseudo stories that are trying to make you unhealthy, make you sick. They're trying to poison your soul. Oh, and they want your kids. They want to get your kids, because the way in which you poison someone, right, is not by giving them a big bottle that says poison on it. The way you poison someone is you give them something in which the poison is concealed. You put sugar or salt around the edge of the cup. You make it go down easy. You make it appear good. You make it a fun experience. You titillate. You give pleasure in some way on the front end in order to get someone to accept that evil is good and good is evil. In order for someone to accept, stories that turn reality on its head and are actually describing contorted visions of reality that are not possible. And if you truly saw what they were saying, you would see that what they are doing is grotesque, disgusting, revolting, because they're poisoning your heart, your mind, your soul through the medium of stories. And it's interesting that, we don't regard this as serious. Stories are just, neutral recreational pastimes. And yeah, that's interesting. Why is Susan Rice, why did she go to the board of Netflix? Why do the Obamas go and get a big deal with Netflix? What do they know that you don't? They just did it for the money? It wasn't just the money. It's the power. Why do people, as soon as they have a box that shows them flickering images, right, on the screen, why do they all of a sudden spend hours every day watching it? I haven't talked about the internet. What about TV? In the space of 10 years, right, post-World War II, you go into the 50s, and all of a sudden it's 1960, and everyone in the world has a TV set, totally new. They have a box that they can just turn on and watch stuff on. People are the same. They weren't any smarter or dumber. They had this box. All of a sudden, everyone's watching it for hours at a time. Completely changes everything. If you don't realize that, stop being an idiot and start thinking about it. All of a sudden, people are spending hours watching images in the box. Whoever puts those images out there is going to have an insane amount of control and be able to manipulate or influence you, your thoughts, your desires, what you think you should have, what you think the rest of the world looks like. You haven't been to the rest of the world. You've seen it through the box. Who's in charge of what comes out of the box? Who's in charge of the flickering images on the walls of the cave? Huh? Whoever that person is has an insane amount of power. And everyone who's anyone knows this. They know this. And if you really know it, you're quiet about it because you're actually behind the scenes in charge, not the people strutting about the stage who you marshal, the actors and maybe some of the directors, even the names you know. You're talking about way behind the scenes. You know the kind of thing that's going to move people in the right way and move people in the wrong way. And in your definition of right and wrong, you're going to push it because you're a human being and because you realize the power and even the duty that comes with that station of being in charge of the flickering lights, being in charge of what people see on the walls of the cave. So, riddle me this. So if it's neutral, first off, people spend now hours, right? I mean, Netflix's only competitor is sleep, as was said a few years ago. We all know the drill where you spend hours, watching this stuff. And it's not like bad in itself, right? We love stories. That's why we're addicted to it. We like stories. We have to be just sit back and be passive and watch a story on the walls of our cave. I mean, it's amazing. But anything you do for a long period of time is not neutral. You know, the idea that entertainment is neutral is sort of a modern insanity. It's a lie, and it's a little ridiculous when you think about it. Let me give you an example. I used to say this in my classes. Example is the Oscars. Every year the Oscars comes on, and the right, a few people still watch that show. I hear. Every year, the right says, "Hey, we don't want these actors and actresses shoving their politics down our throat, and it's ridiculous, and they're all idiots, and blah blah." And I think everyone kind of agrees now. Tinseltown has lost its tinsel; no one cares, and it's declining in ratings precipitously. At the same time, this is my take on this. Of course, they're going to talk about politics because it's not neutral. Oh, Matt, well, it should be neutral. They're just still there to tell stories. And, stories aren't neutral. They can never be neutral. They have morality within them. They have a notion of good and evil and what the human person is within them by necessity. You can't scrub out the morality out of story. That's Looney Tunes talk. You've been taught that by idiots or by people who want you to think it's neutral because they don't want to think too hard about its power, about its importance. Why would they talk about politics at the Oscars? Because if this is the highest ceremony you have for story, and story isn't neutral, but is actually insanely powerful and responsible for how everyone thinks, and it's even more powerful because people don't realize it's so powerful, then you're going to give honor and glory and talk about how you used that power for the sake of the highest good. It's one of the highest forms of power. I mean, who writes? Imagine if you wrote some of these classic stories, right? Virgil, Homer. These are stories that are still read thousands of years later. The power they have exercised over human minds and hearts and society is immense. The power of these movies or TV is immense. And so, of course, they are going to bow down to the gods as they know God and talk about how they're working towards the highest ends possible with their power. And for a lot of them, it's like environmentalism, right? I mean, Leo DiCaprio, when he finally gets his Oscar, of course he's going to talk about the environment and nature. That's his God, right? And so he's trying to say, look, I'm in this position of insane power and I know it. I'm trying to use this for good. That is normal. In fact, that's a healthy attitude to have. Their actual understanding of what's good and evil is completely effed up, don't get me wrong, and insane, and I would just bomb the whole place if I could. But here, the problem is that that they're not wrong about the power they have and its connection to good and evil. You know, the ancient Greeks, when they would have they would host the plays, everyone would show up. You would have honored guests. It was a political and religious event where everyone, they judged them. There was a certain amount of democracy. They judged who was the best playwright. But they knew that what they were watching was imbued with civic and religious power. And it must be sort of blessed by the civic and religious powers. And it was sort of an official event, right? They acknowledged the power. I mean, why does Plato kick the artists out, right, of his imagined community in the Republic? Because the power is so great, they're making people think falsity about the highest things, the gods. They're lying about the highest, the biggest, the deepest question you can ask. Is there a God or not? And they're giving people a vision of that they believe. That's actually how we learn. That's actually, you know, that's actually what's at the heart of any culture. That's the power we're talking about. So it's by necessity political in the big sense. It's by necessity powerful in the big sense. It's the big gun. And this is the importance of story. And it's the power it has over you, whether you realize it or not. The poison comes in a way that feels good. And over time, it starts to influence the way in which you look at the world, the way in which you think about things. And garbage in and garbage out. And all of us, look, all of us, if you're living in this society, have been influenced in some way by this crap. Because, and here's the next step. Because when I say crap, what I mean by it is, you can have very talented people, and a lot of these people are, people who are creative, they're doing this stuff now. A lot of these people are. I mean, obviously, we see loads of incompetence, and you see a lot of that in media today. But there's a lot of insanely talented people. The problem is they don't have the depth of mind or soul to communicate, to use that talent for the sake of story properly understood or story in the deepest sense. And that's primarily because they don't have the education, whether they learn the truth, goodness and beauty through classes or their family or their culture, they don't have that. So garbage in, garbage out. What they think is good or bad is these shallow lies they've been taught. And so they use their talent, they misuse their talent and create these poison pills. Just think about this. I mean, the importance of education here is enormous. If you're not steeped in a knowledge of human nature, and again, none of this has to come from a class. It should come from your faith, your culture, your stories you envelop yourself in. But it doesn't have to come from a class. But still, there's an aspect here where we are dumb, we are uneducated, and therefore we can't write stories anymore. Look, in 1700s America, there were no majors to speak of in college, and you got in by knowing Latin and Greek. You did liberal arts and read old books, and you got out by memorizing arguments about the existence of God and so forth. And that's a very impractical education, right? But all those guys ever did was what? Found America. Very, very impractical education. Impractical documents they wrote, like the Constitution. The kind of education that we focus on today, because it is more real than how liberal arts education has declined, is STEM education, you know, science, technology, math. And the problem with that is, again, it's not imbued with the deeper stuff. The Nazis were getting pretty good at STEM until we stopped them. There's no, what are you going to do with the nuclear bombs you make? What are you going to, you know, you're just going to make stuff and say it's good? Well, welcome to the world we're in. You know, you had people with no deep liberal arts education who laugh at it for good reason, because the liberal arts education today is crap. And they kind of mock, the great booksies. And even if they're conservative, they're just, you know, kind of idiots. And that's kind of true too. But they have no depth of mind. And then they go invent things like Facebook or Google or, you know, and they have no thought for the negative consequences, some of which could have been predicted. They have no understanding of human nature and thus how to create technology that helps, ennoble human nature rather than enslave it. So if you don't believe me, you can just, I have some quotes here that I think, some facts here that are interesting. These fragments I've shored against my runes. a poem by T.S. Eliot. You can look it up if you are uneducated. These fragments I've shored against my runes. I'm going to just grab these pieces to kind of prove the point in this garbage dump on top of the ruins of a once great civilization. Werner Herzog, who is a hilarious, in some ways, brutal in others, documentary filmmaker, who's a character in his own right, has this great quote, read. If you don't read, you will never be a filmmaker. Now, that might not be literally true in all cases, but that is, he's saying that for a reason. If you don't read, you won't be, if you don't pay attention, right, to the details of the writing, if you don't read stories, if you don't read, you will never be a filmmaker, which is typically provocative, Herzog. Aaron Sorkin, don't even get me started on him, complete lib in the worst possible way. But he has this great line about, and he wrote a television series, which I will not name, about politics, which has ruined the souls in precisely the way I'm talking about, and the understanding of what politics is, of many a millennial. Because it is so good and he is so talented, and yet the talent is used in a way that actually is harmful. But his a great line where he says, you should be evangelical about Aristotle's Poetics. If you don't know anything about Aristotle's Poetics, that's okay. Why would you? We are living in a retarded time where, you know, no one teaches these things. But this is a book written thousands of years ago that says a lot about story and what it is and how it works. You should be evangelical about it, said Aaron Sorkin. You know, usually guys like this do not like the old books, right? Especially Aristotle. But nonetheless, he realizes that. He realizes that. He's not just a, you know, just a dummy. The Coen brothers, who have made many movies that I adore, including The Big Lebowski, but also Miller's Crossing, which I think is underrated. So many movies. Very interesting, somewhat nihilistic. But why are they interesting? You know that the title of Ethan Coen's Princeton University thesis for his degree in philosophy was Two Views of Wittgenstein's Later Philosophy. Interesting. Scott Derrickson, who another, I think, sort of, I don't know if he's woke but he was at least interesting for a while politically, I thought. It didn't seem like he was going along with the Borg. But whatever, wherever he is, he went to Biola, which is an interesting Protestant university. And he said once, I learned how to think at Biola. I was exposed to a universe of ideas there, especially in my literature and philosophy classes. I think I got a better education at Biola than many of the Ivy League students I went to grad school with at USC. He attributes much of his philosophy on what it looks like to incorporate his faith into his career to Flannery O'Connor. You know, there was some education there, some knowledge of older stories. Terrence Malick, who made Tree of Life, which I think is one of the works of art of in modern cinema. I understand people who don't like it, but I think it's an incredible work of art. Malick got a degree in philosophy from Harvard, and then he went to Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar, but had a falling out with a professor over his dissertation on the concept of world in Kierkegaard, Heidegger, and Wittgenstein. In 1969, Northwestern University Press published Malick's translation of Heidegger's The Essence of Reasons. Now, I'm not saying that everyone has to be a philosopher who is going to do creative things. That is a stupid thing to think or say. But I am saying that people underestimate the power of story and the depth from which it ought to spring in our culture. And there's a sense in which we do this because we have commercialized it. We don't sacralize it anymore. There's no civic and religious significance to story, which is ridiculous. The other side now knows that there's civic and religious significance to story. Their woke religion will be inculcated in all your kids' schools, and it will be your civic duty to let them look at pornography that grooms them. You can't take it out of your schools. You're already in the grip of a civic and religious system when it comes to art and story. But we pretended that these things were neutral. We pretended that you didn't have to have, they didn't have real civic and religious significance in a serious way, in part because of the way it grew up as in a commercialized mass media environment over the last 100 years. There's pluses and minuses to this, but I think the point I want to make is that hid, that allowed the power of story to hide itself. There's a sense in which, take Los Angeles, likes to wrap itself in this sort of vapid, you know, sexy, skin-deep sort of wrapper, you know, or a camouflage. Because underneath that, when you drive around and think, like, where did all this money come from and all these houses in the West Side, underneath that is an understanding of the depth and power of story that comes from media. And there's almost a sense in which if you denigrate it as, well, this isn't a serious thing, which comes from the envy of the intellectuals and the envy of other sectors of the economy. You know, I'm Wall Street and New York is more serious and blah, blah, blah. The more you think that, the more power you give to the masters of puppets, to the masters of the flickering images on the screen. The more you think it's neutral, the more you think it's all just silly, the more you just treat it as not very important. The images that the entire nation watches for hours at a time, the more power, you know, you hand over to those who create the stories. Now, as technology has arisen, as digital technology has arisen, all of a sudden, because of the kind of thing it is, where it can encode and subsume all the other forms of media within it, it then the power shifts to technology because it's ultimately controlling which feeds you're seeing, right? What you're going to see on the wall at an even deeper level can be controlled by technology. And you even see the symbiosis between, of course, the tech companies and those who are producing the content. But the same principle applies here. In either case, there's an understanding beyond that which we normally talk about in polite company, certainly conservative company, right-leaning company, that the power and depth behind stories is immense, it's enormous, and it's sort of like the ball game for culture. Think about this in terms of education. Just as if I am in charge of hiring all the professors of the state university and all the disciplines and organizing them in some way, that's profound power because now I will influence, because of what those professors do and say and how they're organized, I will influence the minds of, you know, countless students who go through that school and therefore my state, my regime, and everything else. Why? Because people are sitting there, they're listening, and they're interacting and being engaged by a certain cast of mind and certain people proclaiming what the truth is. Similarly with the entire culture, their whole lives. Whoever controls the flickering images, whoever controls the stories, whether it's the news or trying to tell supposedly the real story of what's going on, or whether it's scripted, that is now controlling what you hear 24/7 continuously all the time. And as Abraham Lincoln said, if you control public opinion, that's what what molds the minds, what molds the thoughts of human beings in a democratic republic, then you control the ball game. And this shouldn't be rocket science. It's not like a conspiracy. It's just an obvious human point that we don't think about because we don't understand the power of these forces that we're dealing with. And it makes us very unhappy and it leads to, terrible things. So, I think that what I want to end with or just highlight at the very end is that you're not going to succeed in the culture war or any of these larger battles unless you understand what I'm talking about and respect it. You can't manufacture this stuff. You can't manufacture the talent. You can't take shortcuts to, finding the souls who have been unblemished by all this garbage, who actually see clearly and can then craft, stories beyond imagination now that lead people out and above from all this dreck. It's not an easy task, but if you don't respect this, if you don't respect the power, then and in the civic and religious significance of story and art, then you're not going to win, and you're not actually very serious. You're not actually very serious. You think that you're gonna elect some guy to walk into D.C. who's gonna tame the administrative state, which has only grown, no matter who was there. For some president's gonna save you, a senator. You think a United States senator? We just have more of them and win that, even though we don't even pass budgets anymore, and none of them do anything, and they lose brain cells after two terms and become sort of atrophied and weird, and their skin turns orange, and they codify the hairstyle and the clothing style that they had when they came into office until they're 80 years old. I mean, what are these people going to do for you? You want to actually change the dial? You're serious about the culture war? Then you will respect what story and art are and stop making like lame attempts at changing that, and start rethinking in a deeper, broader way how to foster in a real way what's needed on that front. And it starts for all of us with clearing our minds of the crap and garbage in, garbage out, and starting to take baby steps towards just wallowing in our free time, or when we can, in stuff that's substantial, that has deep wisdom in it. And the stuff that's really good, or it's been around for thousands of years, whatever, I mean, it is deep wisdom. It's like all of a sudden, you've been living in a cave your whole life, and just there's an earthquake, and the cave falls apart around you, and you're just walking on the surface of the earth going, I can't even believe this exists. And then, it occupies the next 10 years of your life. Then you realize there's smaller things, right, that no one even knows about. A small universe that exists and a larger one that exists. I mean, that's what it's like to just enter into one of a lot of these great works. And it's not just a recreational pastime. Again, this is how, especially with children, you pass on wisdom, encoded wisdom, knowledge. And it's not irrational again. It's actually the stuff that moves hearts and minds and allows people to see reality, as it is. That's what good stories do. They allow you to see something in reality that truly is. I could go on. But I hope this is helpful to you. It's just a stab at getting us to respect and revere the real powers that we play with every day when we try to create, or when we lay back, on that couch and turn on the flickering images on the wall of the cave. I want to talk about City on a Hill again. We're going to get some old-time religion up in here. And if you aren't religious or whatever, you should still listen and be interested, because you'll learn some things, regardless of your beliefs. It's going to expand your mind, and it'll help you think about some things that are happening out there and your own life. So there's this book, you may have heard of it, called The Bible. And there is, in the first book of the New Testament, as it's called Matthew. It's a great name. Gift of God. Great name. And in Matthew 5:13, we see this man who calls himself God, who, according to the New Testament, resurrects from the dead after 3 days of being dead. This man who many people who do not believe in the resurrection or the miracles still nonetheless believe that what he taught was revolutionary and good. What he taught was essential for human flourishing. I mean, take Elon Musk, for example, saying, I don't know if Jesus saves people or if he's still alive, but the idea of forgiveness that he taught is very powerful and essential, because if it's just eye for an eye, everyone will go blind. And in order to have social cohesion, right, yada, yada, yada. So anyway, this is one of the famous lines from Jesus Christ preaching to the people. Matthew 5:13. You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot. You are the light of the world. A town built on a hill cannot be hidden. Okay, let me repeat that. You're the salt of the earth, right? But if the salt loses its saltiness, it's worthless. You know, it's not good for anything. Throw it out, trample it underfoot. You're the light of the world. A city on a hilltop. A town on a hill. A city set on a hill. A city lying on a hill. Cannot be hidden. Okay. Next, he says, neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. You know, don't keep your light under a bushel, as the older way goes. In the same way, let your light shine before others that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven. So what's going on here is, if you lose your saltiness, right, you lose your virtue, what sets you apart, something essential about what makes you you, you're worthless. You trample underfoot. You can't make it salty again. And then it's, don't hide your light. The light is made to shine for everyone else. You are the light of the world. A city on a hilltop cannot be hidden. Now, what's the meaning here? That's what I want you to think about. I want you to think about this. And the meaning is in an obvious way, and we'll go forth. What he's saying is, you know, you can't get out of this, right? I mean, you don't hide. You're not supposed to hide away and cut yourself off from the world. You are the light of the world. You are supposed to be like a city on a hill. And this is because you want your light to shine before others that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven. You're going to lead people upwards. You know, if I was to give a secular translation of this, if you're like, oh, well, I'm not Christian, so why should I listen? It's no, if there's goodness in you, you should be drawing people up towards truth, goodness, and beauty, right? And if you're part of the good side, you want to draw people upwards to truth, goodness, and beauty, and therefore you want to be that light. That means that we got to get in better shape physically. That means that we got to get in better shape morally, right? Because we want to be the example to other people to lead them to truth, goodness, and beauty. We will all be happy that way. We will make the world a better place. We will find peace and joy in our lives and just be human, you know, just enjoy being, if we are able to draw people towards what's higher than ourselves, conform ourselves to it. You are the light of the world. A town built on a hill cannot be hidden. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hid. Okay. So this sets up the city on the hill for America. And this fast forward to 1630 and John Winthrop's words to the early Americans. He says, thus stands the cause between God and us. We are entered into covenant with him for this work. We have taken out a commission. The Lord hath given us leave to draw our own articles. We have professed to enterprise these and those accounts. Upon these and those ends, we have hereupon besought him of our favor and blessing. But here's the deal. Now, if the Lord shall please to hear us and bring us in peace to the place we desire, then hath he ratified this covenant and sealed our commission, and will expect a strict performance of the articles contained in it. But if we neglect the observation of these articles and are under the bargain, which are the ends we have propounded, and dissembling with our God shall fall to embrace this present world and prosecute our carnal intentions, seeking great things for ourselves and our posterity, the Lord will surely break out in wrath against us and be revenged of such a people and make us know the price of the breach of such a covenant. Now, the only way to avoid this shipwreck and to provide for our posterity is to follow the counsel of Micah, Old Testament prophet, to do justly, to love mercy, to walk humbly with our God. For this end, we must be knit together in this work as one man. So, brotherly affection, familiar commerce with each other, delight in each other. We have to work together. We have to keep the union of the Spirit in the bond of peace. The Lord will dwell among us. We have to work together to build this community, right? And we'll be fine if we do that. He shall make us a praise and glory that men shall say of succeeding generations, succeeding plantations, may the Lord make it like that of New England. For we must consider that we shall be as a city upon a hill, the eyes of all people are upon us. So, as I've said before, this was never about triumphalism or American exceptionalism in the way the idiots preach and teach. It was always a warning. It was a warning. If we deal with God falsely, we are going to show him up and make a mockery of God, and he won't take kindly to it, and we will make a mockery of ourselves. Therefore, let us choose life, that we and our seed may live by obeying his voice and cleaving to him, for he is our life and prosperity. Now, I would say every pastor in the damn nation ought to have their congregation consider this sermon today and meditate on it. Where is Christianity in America now? Christians can hardly defend themselves. What manner of life are they proposing to themselves and others? Where is the damn city on the, where's the city on the hill? What are we doing to shine, you know, that light for truth, goodness, and beauty for God? God forbid. What light are we shining? Where is it? Show me the parish. Show me the church. Show me the town. Can I see an actual city? Can I see an actual city? Oh, that sounds weird. I mean, we shouldn't. Where's the city on the hill? Where's your example? Let's look at your Christian universities, your Catholic universities. Where's your art? What's your Christian art look like? Is that shining a light? I mean, it should be leading all kinds of people to the truth. Where's that? There should be museums full of it, right? For the last 100 years of all the beautiful things you've created. Where is that? Show it to me. Oh, well, no doubt you're on top of using digital technology, which is revolutionizing the world, and in some ways it's like the invention of the printing press. In some ways, like the monasteries, the repository of knowledge is the data center. I'm sure you've been thinking about those things, church, right? Do you use that as part of the city on the hill? Draw people to truth, goodness, beauty, God, Jesus? No. Something has gone terribly wrong. How fares the city on the hill? Where is it? I don't see it. I don't see it. How fares the light of the world? Okay, it's obvious that we must seriously reconsider and reevaluate how we must live. It's obvious that if the city is to survive at all, if it even exists, it must be refounded. The light must be relit. And this is the task before us now. Without this, nothing, by the way. You think you can just slide. You want to be the salt of the earth. We all want to be by just like, I'm going to have my comfy little life within America. I don't have to combine and do these things. I don't have to really push myself very hard. And somehow it'll all be fine. I'll survive. No, you will lose your salt. You'll be trampled underfoot. I mean, this is not even, again, I can make a secular version of this case. If you aren't willing to stand up for truth, goodness, and beauty, you aren't willing to stand up for virtue, you will be trampled underfoot. You've lost your salt. Doesn't matter. There's no light coming from you. You see the way the world is going. You don't want to band together and build the city on the hill. It's done. It's over. So, between warning about the salt that's lost its saltiness and pointing out you don't hide a candle under a bushel, that's when then Christ says this. I mean, so this is Jesus saying this. So if you are Christian, you believe in this, the options are clear. I mean, the city must now be rebuilt or refounded. You don't have a choice. That's your duty. That's your calling. That's your vocation. And oh, by the way, if you don't do it, you're all going to be destroyed. There's only one way. The wind is blowing right now if you do nothing. So this leaves no room for hiding, right? No room for victimhood mentalities either. Like, oh, we're just persecuted. There's nothing we can do. No room for quiet despair and dissolution. Like, well, it's terrible. You know, I wish people were better, but I can't do anything about it. You are the light and the city cannot be hid. You are the light and the city cannot be hid. So rebuild or be trampled underfoot. Those are your options. Those are your options. I've said enough. And I just hope that those whose job it is to think about such things and to preach such things start doing so with renewed vigor. Because if we don't, we will continue to be atomized. This society will continue to be atomized, and we will lose. And we will deserve to lose because we are losers. If we aren't willing to stand up and lead, not, oh, I'm going to defend and blah, 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 and we just don't be persecuted. No, we're going to build the city on the hill that light will shine from, or we are losers. Let's be winners about this. Where are the Christians leading? The shining a light, they should be leading in all these areas, on the cutting edge, as the people in charge. And if you don't see that and begin to internalize it and begin to try to become excellent in order to do it, then you don't deserve to win. You deserve to lose. I don't want to lose. I know it's not all up to human effort and all of us, but we certainly should try. We certainly should try, because otherwise we don't deserve that grace. Of course, no one deserves grace, and grace is needed. These are mysteries. But if you're not willing to start reevaluating your life and thinking about what you can do and what Christians ought to be doing as leaders, as the people in charge, as the people pushing us forward, and you're not willing to rebuild that city on a hill, we know what is going to happen. And it won't be good. It won't be good for us. It won't be good for our kids. So, final thought. There's something encouraging in this. This is something we can do together. This is something that gives us a lot of meaning, purpose, and joy along the way, as bad as things are or bad as things get. They can get way worse than this. I mean, there's all kinds of awesome things we can do together now. There's all kinds of incredible, beautiful things we can foster now. And now is the time to band together and do it. Thank you. Well, we are going to end it there, although there is always plenty more to say. These are two issues that I have written about, at least privately, and spoken about in some way, and hope to both write and speak about more, except it's hard to have time because we're actually trying to build real things. But in any event, you need to get in touch with me if you're interested about either of the two topics today at docmjp, docmjp at Twitter. If you like any of this, consider going to New Founding. Don't consider going to New Founding. Go to newfounding.com and then consider and join us. If you join us, you're supporting the show. You're supporting our efforts. And there's a lot that we're doing behind the scenes. There's a lot of exciting new products we will be offering. And we appreciate that support. And that support helps us prove to investors that this is real. This is real. And this is a movement that is not going to stop. Because we aren't going to stop until we win. Come with us if you want to live, newfounding.com. And remember, the only way out is through. There's no way around it. In the meantime, stay awake, stay alive, stay healthy, stay limber. We need you that way.